This is the Saxo Market Call, the daily financial markets podcast, across asset classes and around the world.
Hello and welcome to the Saxo Market Call. It is Tuesday, 23rd of May, 2023. And heading into our Friday listeners podcast, we've put out a new survey. So please have a look at the link. It's in the podcast description. We've also put that link in the slide deck for today's slide deck. And you can have a look at that. There's a couple of questions to get the sense of the mood from our listeners on a couple of questions about where they think the market is going here. Always interesting to see if people are bullish on the dollar, on commodities, and on the U.S. equity market. Those are the three questions, and a big free question area also to queue up some questions for us for our Friday's listener edition podcast, both this week and next week. And tomorrow, if we can get our business together here, we'll also be doing our first of the so-called Wednesday helicopter editions, where we look sort of taking maybe more like a 5,000 foot view, if you will, of a topic. I think we might look at where the economy is, taking assessment on recession risks here. So stay tuned for that as well. But please do go in. We had such a great response for the first of these listener edition surveys. Please have a look at that link and of course, take the survey. All right, back down to business. Peter, we're remarking today, one of the most interesting things we're seeing is this continued sort of, the rally isn't continuing, but we're staying quite elevated here in the U.S. equity market, despite the risks of where liquidity may be taken post a debt ceiling deal. The irony being, once we clear the catastrophe scenario, that there actually could be some risks to the market from a liquidity angle. That seems to be what is pressuring, maybe at least, the U.S. Treasury market, and we'll have some thoughts on that, and the dollar as well. But the equities are just sort of smooth sailing here, but a pretty curious set of circumstances. I don't know if you agree.
Yeah, I mean, it's at least an equity market that is not worried about a recession. It's not really worried about a U.S. debt ceiling at this point. You can see that from the VIX. You can see it from the pricing. We had another day yesterday. We talked about it on the podcast, this phenomenon with rising U.S. bond yields in tandem with higher equities. It's typically a sign that you have a shift in the market's interpretation and its perception of what's going on with economic growth. And I think that, as we talked about, we had this wonderful headline. Was it last week or a week before that? Maximum confusion. I think that still is a theme that is rhyming pretty well with the temperature among investors. There's definitely two camps, and there's one that are looking for a very hard landing, and those that are more in either a very mild soft landing to the economy, or it never becomes a landing. It's just a takeoff, and we'll see. I think the jury is still out. There's a lot of data points. It's sticking in all directions. That's still my thesis. And if you look at the global industry group's performance yesterday, you could also see here that the pro-cyclical industries like media, entertainment, automobiles, even real estate and banks were leading the gains yesterday. And then semiconductors, despite the fallout for Microsoft, Micron. Which was banned on some of its memory chips by China over some security-related issues. So, but that industry group as a whole was actually holding line pretty well, unchanged for the day.
Yeah, there's a lot going on in the semiconductor front. On that note, there was an FT article discussing the plans Japan has to restrict, I think it was 23 types of semiconductor-making equipment for export to China. And there was some Chinese executive quotas saying these sanctions actually look worse than what the U.S. is planning to do, and would limit even the much lower quality or lower end, if you will, chips down to something like a 45 nanometer process, where it looks like the U.S. sanctions are focused more on the 14 to 16 nanometer technology, the smaller the nanometer being sort of the higher powered, higher end chips. So it's just galloping these types of issues. But let's get back to the market developments. And we saw the Treasury yields extending higher again, highest close once again since the turmoil back in March with the banking system, the Silicon Valley Bank collapse, and the other banks that were under pressure there. And just to point out, on slide four, the 10-year, we're still pretty much halfway into the range. There's a lot of range to work with. The 30-year, though, the very longest end of the U.S. yield curve, getting a bit more interesting, a bit more spicy there at that 4% level. If we're breaking above that, we really need to start to assess what the impact, I would imagine, is into the equity market for sure. But interesting to see also, of course, how the Treasury market reacts to the big issuance splits that will be coming once we do see, presumably, a deal on the debt ceiling, lifting of the debt ceiling limit. Let's go to you, though, Ole, on gold. You're still focusing, I guess, on that 1950 level there. That was the local report. It wilted together with this fresh rise in yields.
It did indeed, and that it is really that the recent rise in yields, which has also been supporting the dollar, that is driving this correction that we're seeing right now. So far, it's a relatively, I'll say, shallow correction, and the market's focused on that 1950 level. I think the biggest short-term challenge, obviously still watching yields, watching direction of short-term rates. We can now see the December SOFR contract is only pricing in, what, 33 basis points worth of cuts. And that was, you know, close to 1% more than a month ago. And on top of that, just the speculative interest in the market. We know that gold has been a very favored commodity for a while from hedge funds. And we're starting to see a reduction there, and that will have an impact. So watch out for that 1950 level as a key area. If we see some further weakness below that, that could trigger some additional long liquidation. But we're still seeing this as temporary. The peak rate is getting close. The recession risk is still there, so plenty of reasons for gold still to be in demand. And we can actually see that, just skipping the Brent and coming back to that. But I'll just put in the slide with some of the ETFs tracking commodities on slide 8, and you can see the 1 month flow has really been predominantly going into the gold market, both in the usage ETFs that we can trade in Europe, and also the global ones. So gold remains in demand, even though we're seeing this correction at this point in time. And interestingly enough, it's actually in second place. We're starting to see some demand coming back into the oil market, and that obviously has been under pressure for a while. So that's starting to show some looking for some. Well, basically, we're getting close to the trading near the low end of the range, and that's attracting some fresh demand.
All right, let's going back to the equity market. It would have been a good lead-in. We're talking about this U.S. equity market, which pretty elevated, but and you know, trying to break these big ranges. But there are some other areas where we're seeing equities just galloping, and especially in Japan. Very impressive chart there. You have Peter on slide 5. You know, the Topix, which is the broader market, right, versus the Nikkei, which gets traditionally the focus, which is sort of like the mega cap of the Japanese market. But incredible returns there. What do you think is driving this? Is it a global focus on what the valuations in Japan are relative to much of the rest of the world?
Yeah, I'm taking the opportunity on slide 5 to flag my equity note from yesterday. Shameless self-promotion, to say the least. But title Japan and Greece, the two comeback countries. And it's because Greek equities were up 7% yesterday, up 31% for the year. Impressive there. And that was because of the Greek election result, with the central right prime minister getting re-elected by a wide margin. So I think that was the market, you know, repricing Greece with very little political risk going forward. A lot of positive reforms, the debt-to-GDP ratio, which is still high, it's coming down. The unemployment rate is back to levels that we had in 2004. So it's come down from 33% to just around 10.5% on the unemployment rate there for Greece. So a lot of pain for a long period, but the market seems to be providing the benefit of the doubt here to Greece. And for those investors back in the days, they're actually dared investing in Greece back in 2012, 13, 14, you have actually got a 10% annualized return in euros. So that's pretty impressive. And then Japan, as you talked about, John, it's the other comeback country, up 16.5% total return this year in yen terms, a little bit less, of course, in dollar terms because of the exchange rate developments there. But the, you know, the ones that know their market history will know that Japan went through an epic financial bubble during the 80s. Back in the days, the talk was that with Japan buying all of California real estate, would they take over the U.S.? They were highly successful in key export industries like, you know, car manufacturing, etc. And then the whole bubble burst, and you had the Barings Bank that went bust, and a famous movie about this trader. What was his name?
Nick Leeson,
exactly, that was speculating, etc. And then we had this very long period with, you know, talk about, you know, zombie banks, low growth, etc. But around 2012, Abenomics, with the former prime minister back then, Shinzo Abe, he changed basically the economic landscape for Japan. It was a very direct set of economic policies that were set in motion to One, generate some more inflation. Two, get women back into the get women into the labor market, because the labor participation rate had been so awfully low for so many years compared to OECD countries, and it just created an economic turn of events. And recently, we talked about Japan, Japanese equities, because Warren Buffett and Berkshire Hathaway had taken a sizable position, and they are actually increasing their exposure. The Japanese equity market is priced at a 50% discount to the U.S. equity market. It offers a higher dividend yield compared to the U.S. equity market. It's one of those markets in the OECD countries with the lowest debt levels in the corporate sector, so very little interest rate sensitivity. And then to add back to your story, John, Japan is part of this, what can you call it, a group of countries that are, you know, changing the global supply chain and the, you know, inside the fragmentation game, you know, setting up these different types of bans against export bans on selling semiconductors to China. And I suspect Japan is actually beginning to join that group of winning countries, as I call it in the equity note: Vietnam, Indonesia, Malaysia, Thailand, India, and Mexico. And maybe Japan is also joining this group as a potential production hub for certain things in Asia, as a lot of companies are trying to diversify their supply chain.
Very high end and automated things, I would imagine.
Yeah,
of course,
robotics and automation.
In the case of things that are actually being produced on Japanese soil. Very interesting story there. In FX, the pattern is with higher U.S. yields, you have the firmer U.S. dollar, and we're working in some pretty interesting areas. Look at Eurodollar. It was testing below 108 last I looked at it before we jumped in here. I imagine that might have been on the preliminary Eurozone manufacturing and services survey releases for May. Don't have those live for you as we're talking here, but of course, you know, those are available on the news feeds. The yen suffering at the hand of these higher yields, and the Kiwi really sticking its neck out here ahead of the RBNZ meeting tonight at really critical areas and things like Aussie Kiwi. You can see there on the chart there on slide six with the overview. 106 area is broken below that, but does this, I think the bar is quite high for the RBNZ to sort of meet hawkish expectations and exceed them. They've shown their sort of hawkish credentials before, though, so they could yet do it. But that 106 line, I would say, is the line in the sand for sort of the continued bear trend view versus a reversal if they do disappoint on their guidance. They could even do something like hike 50, which most don't expect them to do, but then guide dovish, so guide for a significant pause, which could effectively slightly lower the longer-term expectations curve for the RBNZ. So that'll be the big one overnight. And then, of course, we want to watch reactivity around the U.S. debt ceiling issue when and if it is resolved in coming days, presumably. All right, we cut you off a little bit there on your commodity discussion or with the oil. It looks like from the chart things are settling into a very tight range there price-wise. But you have mentioned there's a lot of interest now in positioning front, at least in ETFs, but what about the short position?
Yeah, and that's the interesting one, because the market has settled down, and right now if you look at the supply side, Russian exports continue to rise. You can see that on the insert from Bloomberg. But at the same time, the OPEC production cuts at the start of April, which was predominantly done by the Middle Eastern producers, it's really only now that it's starting to have an impact on supply. So we have an interesting battle there. But another battle is in the paper market, in the speculative trading market, between long and shorts. And we remember that the production cut back in April, part of the reason mentioned once again by the Saudi energy minister, was their hate against short sellers trying to decide what the price of oil should be when they should really be in control. And the short was reduced quite significantly, as you can see on the top right hand chart. But since then, the short has been growing again, because hedge funds, they don't have long memories. They don't really look at the politics or fundamentals. They look at what the price is telling them. And recently, the price action has been telling them to increase short positions once again. So it's interesting. We got an OPEC meeting coming up in the beginning of June. We also have a conference today in Qatar where the Saudi oil minister is going to speak. So with that short in mind, I think the downside risk in crude oil is fading fast at this point.
All right. And then we had a interesting pandemic era superstar Zoom reporting. I suppose it was after the close last night, Peter, but
yes.
You really need to take a logarithmic chart next time there on slide nine. Crazy to think that Zoom shares trade north of $550 and they're currently in their 70s. But take us through what they said in yesterday's call.
Yeah, and that's actually a great segue into, I promised, which would be a, I don't know whether it's funny, but I thought it was an interesting pattern that we're observing, right? Because as you rightly said, Zoom back in the early days of the pandemic was flying to the moon, you know, above $500 per share. It looks ridiculous now in hindsight. And there was this whole idea that, you know, work from home would be the new way of working, and that would take over. And it, what happened was that it did happen, but at the same time, we got Microsoft going all in on Teams, and Teams had a big, much better distribution than Zoom. So Zoom sort of took the long tail of smaller companies, and then the Teams took really the big enterprises. So there was an actual cap on the fundamentals there for Zoom. And what happened then was that as we got the vaccines, we got back a lot of talk about workers coming back to offices in the US. That has certainly happened here in Europe, but it has been a little bit more lackluster in the US. And we even had Elon Musk the other day saying it was morally wrong, almost like he's a god, to work from home. And here's the kicker. So you see the Zoom here, the share price has come down. You would think, okay, people are not working from home any longer. This is not a trend that we thought. But they are in the US because office real estate stocks are down to multi-decade lows. So employees are not returning back to office. But they are, on the other hand, you're not seeing these work from home stocks like Zoom. So what trend do we have, basically? What is the signal, right? I don't know. It's just, I just find it quite interesting that office stocks are doing bad, and even Zoom stock is doing bad. So nothing is really doing well in that part of the economy. The shares were up 1%. They did put out a fiscal year revenue guidance that were a little bit above consensus, not by much. I think this is a company that will eventually go into live a life just like Dropbox. So it had its years of, you know, growth, and it went to a certain level. It would then be squeezed by other competitors, and it will stay in a very low growth where you just need to optimize the business and you know, get as much capital back to shareholders as possible. It will not be a big business. That's my view, at least. We flagged it yesterday. Palo Alto Networks, cybersecurity stocks, some of the best parts of the equity market the past week. A lot of growth expected, as you can see here in the little insert on slide 10. Plus 20%. There is a big read today in one of the financial newspapers here in Denmark. There is just basically constant 24/7 cybersecurity attacks on Danish ports and logistics companies. I guess that would be the same pattern we observe in Europe, maybe also in the US and other countries as well. Of course, it's a global phenomenon, and demand is just extremely red hot. I've talked about this theme many times before. So when we launched the cybersecurity theme basket, and it is the top two topic discussed in every single major boardroom around the world. So this is just if you're not part of this trend in your long-term equity portfolio, I think you're making a mistake. But whatever company you buy, I don't know, you can also buy the ETF, but at least go have a look at our cybersecurity theme basket in the Saxo Trader System for inspiration, or go with an ETF. A little bit of a preview. I'll be writing a preview today on the NVIDIA earnings, which are the big menu this week. Tomorrow, they will be reporting after the US market close. And this is really a stock that is in big focus given all the AI hype that has really been driving a lot of the US equity market performance, and especially NVIDIA, because they are the ones that are selling the shovels for this gold rush in AI.
Yeah, and I saw just that name AutoZone reporting today. I had a thought. I would fear for the longer-term business model of that company as an auto parts company, because EVs, as they slowly take over, have way fewer, to the tune of a tiny percentage, of the moving parts of an internal combustion engine. So just curious to see if there's a damper on the prospects of a company like that. So yeah, interesting names for the rest of the week, even as the earnings season is at a low ebb here. All right, let's go to the macro calendar. A ridiculous number of items there on the calendar for today. I will not take you through these one by one, but do note we have all these preliminary manufacturing services PMI, and do note that the US one gets thoroughly ignored, I think largely for good reason. It makes no sense. We saw this S&P Global survey of the U.S. Services sector bottoming out at 45 back in December, and every single month since then improving through April's 53.6. It's expected slightly lower today. What are we supposed to make of that when we've seen the more traditionally focused or ISM services survey in focus which was at something like 55.5 in November. It had a crazy dip in December, and then has been all over the map lately, a bit weaker at 51.9 in April. So just really frustrating lack of takeaways from those. Yes, they do ask different sized companies. I think the S&P Global asks a smaller there are companies that they're surveying are on average smaller than the ISM, but it only seems to be Europe that gets a little bit of market impact when these are released. We also have a Richmond Fed Manufacturing Index, and then one of these interesting smaller services surveys, which has really been horrible. The Philadelphia one, market doesn't pay much attention to that, but it's an interesting data point. New home sales, and then the big one tonight is the RBNZ rate announcement and press conference. Do they surprise hawkish? Do they clear that hawkish bar after this latest bump to the QE? And keep in mind, those UK data releases are in quite early, 6 o'clock GMT, so that UK CPI release tomorrow morning. And auctions this week, what do you do with an auction when you have the debt ceiling risk afoot? It doesn't seem to be affecting it so far, but watch out for those auctions, 2s, 5s, and 10s today, tomorrow, and Thursday, respectively. All right, that's it for today. Do go out and have a look at that survey and give us some answers and give us some inspiration for our Friday Listeners Edition. And we'll be back tomorrow, of course, with the Saxo Market Call.
Thanks for listening. This has been the Saxo Market Call. For feedback and questions, reach out to us on Twitter @SaxoMarketCall or by email, marketcall@saxobank.com.